So my name is Ria Vorha. Red Cross, Red Crescent and International Alert wanted to provide this media call to help contextualise a first-of-its-kind event happening on Monday and Tuesday in Istanbul. It's the World Humanitarian Summit and it's considered Ban Ki-moon's swan song. It's going to bring together UN agencies, aid organisations and governments to discuss how to reshape aid in the modern world. This is at a time when crises are happening on multiple fronts and the dollars that we have aren't stretching far enough. To talk about what this all means and against a backdrop of a year in which we had a climate agreement, the Sustainable Development Goals and the Sendai Disaster Risk Reduction Framework, I'm pleased to be joined by Janani Vivekananda, Head of Environment, Climate Change, Security at International Alert, Dr. Martin van Aalst, Director of the Red Cross, Red Crescent Climate, and of course, Andrew Holland, Director of Studies and Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate at the American Security Project. We're going to hear from each of the three of those colleagues, and then we'll open the floor for questions. If you want to go ahead, Janani, that would be wonderful.
Great. Thank you. I just want to make three points, really. Firstly, what's the point of the summit? What can we do about it? And what will this actually achieve? So firstly, what's the point of the summit? The reason the summit's coming about is because the context of humanitarian operations has changed. Crises are becoming more complex, more conflict-ridden, and more protracted. Increasingly, climate change-driven extremes such as droughts, floods and typhoons are interacting with other pressures, other social and economic pressures like widening inequality, rapid urbanization, and political instability to complex ends. The case of Syria illustrates this in a very depressing way. The drought that Syria experienced from 2006 to 11 clearly played a role. It's not to say that it was the sole cause of the conflict. However, it contributed, interacting with other factors that were already there, grievances against the Assad regime, and it contributed to the initial unrest and protests through the loss of livelihoods and distress migration experienced by the farmers who were affected by that drought. And subsequently, the humanitarian impact of the Syria conflict we're facing today is 4.5 million currently displaced, 250,000 dead, and 13.5 million in urgent need of humanitarian assistance. So we're facing the greatest humanitarian need since World War II, and the money that we have to support this humanitarian need just isn't enough. There's an estimated funding gap of $15 billion. So the system can't cope with demand, and so we need to look at how we can reduce need, and we can do this by a focus on prevention. The international community has been in a state of crisis management, reacting to events that are unfolding rather than proactively addressing root causes. And trading humanitarian needs off against long-term developmental or peace-building spending is counterproductive because money not spent on prevention will result in greater need later on. But what sounds like something that's completely obvious is anything but, and prevention is still heavily underfunded. The UN High-Level Panel on Humanitarian Financing report, for example, highlights very starkly this same point. It states that 12 out of a group of 23 low-income countries received less than $10 million for disaster risk reduction over 20 years whilst receiving $5.6 billion in disaster response. So if climate change disasters and conflict are interlinked, so too must be our responses. And yet they're not. In the global deals that came out of 2015, the Sustainable Development Goals, the Paris Agreement on climate change, the Sendai Framework on disaster risk reduction, there is no explicit recognition of these linked risks. And where they're present, there's no imperative to act on them in a joined-up fashion. And the World Humanitarian Summit thus provides an opportunity to recalibrate and provide and incentivize the aid system to focus on cooperation across these different sectors and to focus on prevention. And doing this will help us to not only meet the shared responsibility to provide humanitarian assistance to those in need, but also help to reduce those needs. Thanks.
Thanks, Janani. I'd like to hand over to Martin now to give us his perspective from Red Cross Red Crescent.
Of the growing crisis in the humanitarian system, the shortfall in funding to respond to the most basic needs, the increasing demand for humanitarian services, in an increasingly volatile world. And I think that's immediately where the connection with climate change comes in. We are already in a more volatile climate, and it's making our humanitarian work more challenging. Just to give a few examples, Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, 93% of the people were actually not killed by the direct storm impacts, but by the storm surge. That storm surge already contains an element of sea level rise. It applies actually across the world. Of course, we have a similar sea level challenge with Sandy in New York, which flooded metro stations that wouldn't have flooded without sea level rise. The Netherlands faced heat waves recently, killing 1,000 people, getting it into the top five of most deadly natural disasters. Of course, the impacts are much bigger in the most vulnerable places and primarily in developing countries, and even more primarily in the most fragile states. The classical example being the drought in the Horn of Africa 2010-2011. It's not by coincidence that most of the people that died in that drought were in Somalia, where we had a protracted crisis and people didn't have a functioning system to protect them from the worst impact. So it's good we're discussing that. It's a cross-cutting issue. It's not going to be solved by humanitarian response alone. We will need good humanitarian response, and there are ways we can improve humanitarian response, particularly by also better involving local actors. It's going to be a combination of the independent humanitarian aid that we need plus the local response. But we'll also need much more than response. And that's where this whole continuum from humanitarian issues to development and even climate adaptation comes in. And there's a real challenge that those communities are hardly talking. So if there's one thing that I hope the humanitarian summit will bring, it's that it's strengthening that conversation. Because the problem of the World Humanitarian Summit is not going to be solved by the humanitarian community alone. And in that sense, it's also very good to see that the Sustainable Development Goals and the Paris Agreement both reference resilience a lot of times. It's right that there's not the very explicit references to humanitarian work, but there is the recognition that we need a much more risk-informed approach to development. And in fact, it's clear that unless we tackle these rising climate and disaster risks, we will not meet the basic targets of the Sustainable Development Goals, and we will actually see 100 million people dropping back into extreme poverty by 2030. There are solutions for some of these challenges. Again, it's risk-informed development. That's a lot of programming outside of the humanitarian world, often by national governments and local actors in developing countries. It's also things that can be done better by humanitarian actors and humanitarian donors themselves, and particularly in the sphere of natural disasters. That includes so-called forecast-based financing, where we are currently still unable to activate early actions based on a forecast of a likely disaster, but not yet 100% certain disaster, because humanitarian donors are only coughing up after the fact. We can prove mathematically that it's worth their while to spend those dollars in advance. It reduces suffering and it increases cost effectiveness. Simple example, distributing chlorine tablets ahead of a flood instead of treating patients of a cholera outbreak after the flood. You can get the flood wrong a couple of times in your forecast and still have massive savings if you do this a number of times. There is movement in the humanitarian system towards such innovations, and I think the donor community is also considering how to make its systems more flexible. But once again, the most important expectation is a handover and a recognition of this humanitarian development continuum, and then including the climate financing discussions that are held in the post-Paris landscape, and particularly ensuring that we target more of those towards the most vulnerable countries and within those countries the most vulnerable groups. I'll leave it there. Thank you.
I guess
thank you so much. Yeah. Indeed. Go ahead, Andrew. Thank you.
Yeah, I guess that leads it to me. At the American Security Project, we're a national security think tank, so I wanted to talk about kind of the military and national security link with humanitarian crises and the ongoing threat of climate change. You know, at this summit, we have to think about humanitarian crises almost as kind of a 21st century hybrid crisis. As we've got things like disasters like droughts and floods or storms combining with things like massive urbanization, already existing migrant flows, and then things like terrorism and extremism that are creating this kind of cocktail of crises that aren't just one, it's many. And so we have to think about how militaries can and humanitarian groups need to work together. We need to think about how to reform humanitarian assistance kind of away from knee-jerk reaction and move to thinking about resilience and foresight. ASP's work we have a product called the Global Security Defense Index that found about 70% of the countries in the world define climate change as a security risk, and they're working on ways to reduce that risk. But we shouldn't think that this is a military mission alone. This is a whole of government and even whole of society, with NGOs and humanitarian groups have to be involved with this. Martin, I think, talked about Typhoon Haiyan, and he's right. This is kind of an example that I cite a lot. Is this was an acute climate threat. You know, 195 mile an hour sustained winds, maximum recorded at landfall ever in history. Water levels 46 feet above mean sea level, just crazy storm surge, and 7,000 people died. But I want to. What's important to look at is actually that this is kind of a story of a successful response, as tragic as it was, because the U.S. carrier battle group showed up within days, as well as a massive humanitarian response from around the world, and they were able to kind of prevent a lot of deaths and frankly also a growing security crisis. In the days after the storm, we saw riots and kind of a collapse into disorder in Tacloban. Eight people were killed, for example, in a rice riot. There was reports of Maoist insurgents in the interior fighting against government aid convoys, and the massive humanitarian and military response, kind of this hybrid response that we talked about, was able to stop that decline into lawlessness. And, you know, when we talk about the climate security threat, we say it's a threat multiplier, and it's kind of this cycle down from climate change into conflict. But you can cut that cycle down. You can cut that chain of causation, and they were able to do that in Haiyan. You know, again, as tragic as it was, it could have been much worse if the world hadn't come together to respond to it as it did. Now, that was an example of a response, but we need to do more to think about resilience, especially in areas like the Asia Pacific, where we know there is extreme and high disaster risks, and we need to be thinking about this more as a foresight exercise and look forward. You know, we need to address resilience instead of waiting for those disasters to hit and then the conflict to erupt. We should take preemptive action with foresight. So happy to take questions and go from there.
Thank you so much to Janani, Martin and Andrew. I'd like to offer a brief moment for questions in case there are any lurkers out there. If not, we're going to make this recording available. And again, once again, I'd really like to underline my thanks to the colleagues who have made profound connections today and mapped out a future in which these different spheres can work together and create better results for people on the ground and the people that they're trying to serve. Okay. Thank you all very much for your time. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Pleasure. And might see some of you in Istanbul.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it. I got my confirmation last night, so I'll be there with bells.
Excellent. We'll see you there then.
Thank you, Ria.
Safe travels all. Thank you.
Bye.